Thank you, Mr. Purdy, and good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to Sabbath Services. We had begun back in January a Bible study on the book of Ezra. We did that January, February. Took a month off in March to cover a Bible study more specifically related to the Passover itself. So today we'll pick up with Ezra Part 3. And since it has been 8 weeks since we began, or since our last installment, I thought we would take just a moment to review what we've covered up to this point. That way, if you've missed anything or just a little rusty on where we are, we'll catch you up to date there. As we mentioned, Ezra was a leader of the Jewish people during the period that we call the Restoration. The Restoration was a time when the tribes of Judah, or at least portions of the tribe of Judah and Benjamin and Levi, returned to the land of Judah, specifically the area of Jerusalem, after the Babylonian captivity. They had been in captivity for 70 years, and so basically, not the first generation or the second, but now the third generation probably are the ones that are making their way after captivity back to the promised land. So you can certainly almost assuredly believe that no one who had lived in Judea was now returning. That generation probably had all died. Now it is possible that a very young child might now be a, octogenarian and traveling back, but that's highly unlikely. So these would have been people that have never lived in this area before. All they would have are stories from those that were passed on before them. And now it's likely, just as a point of background that we haven't covered before, it's likely that the people remembered it quite a bit nicer than it was actually ever the case. Ever had that nostalgia where you go back to your childhood home after 20 or 30 years and you wonder, what was so special about this? It's a small place. It's more crowded than I remember. It's just different. Of course, once it's been destroyed, it would be very different. So they're probably looking at it in one sense as a glorious place, as a wonderful place, and of course later on they'll get there and they'll find out this place is ruined. It's a destroyed area still after all this time. So that will be part of their background. The restoration, of course, was initiated by Cyrus the Persian. As we mentioned, the Persian Empire became the largest empire up to that time to rule this area of the world. And the Persian policy was quite different from the Assyrian or the Babylonian policies of dealing with captive peoples. The Persians, Cyrus specifically, encouraged native religions to be restored. He had even advanced funds to be able to rebuild temples. His theory was that two things would happen. Number one, he might please the local gods by allowing their temples to be rebuilt. And secondarily, he would win the favor of the captive peoples if he allowed them to exercise their own religious rights. So it was a pretty far-sighted policy. We mentioned that Judah, in three stages, returned to the area of Judah. First of all, under Zerubbabel, at the time of Cyrus's decree in 538. The second group under Ezra that we're reading about here, or will be reading about here, in 457 approximately. And then the third group under Nehemiah about 30 years later in 444 B.C. Again, we talked about Ezra being the one to write the book of Ezra and Nehemiah as well as Chronicles. We talked about how in Ezra we might know him as the chronicler, because he chronicled many, or compilers as well. He compiled a lot of lists here for the book of Ezra. We also covered prophecies in Jeremiah and Isaiah that relate to the captivity. We won't go back there now. But then we also talked about the first five, six, seven verses of the book as well. So what we'll do is just go ahead and jump in now as a continuation from the previous Bible study with verse 7. As you know, Cyrus, it says, the king brought forth the vessels of the house of the Eternal. Ezra chapter 1 and verse 7. So the articles of the temple were released to be returned to Jerusalem with the immigrants. Now, when you think of vessels, normally we think of cups. Literally, the word means to hold, something that holds another thing. Can also be translated utensils or implements. In one case, it's translated tool, the word that's used here. So everything that had to do with service in the temple was now being returned, at least everything that had been taken by the Babylonians. Now, if you hold your finger here in Ezra chapter 2, or as we've mentioned before, grab the 3x5 in the front of your Bible, put it in Ezra, turn with me to 2 Kings chapter 24. 2 Kings chapter 24. We'll read verses 10 through 13, because it describes what the Babylonians took. In other words, they took all the things of value out of the temple and brought them into the pagan temple, probably the temple of Marduk, in Babylon. And they were stored there. And the interesting thing is that they were very carefully cataloged. Normally, you think of an invading power just coming in and ransacking the place, just grabbing everything and running. But these things were very carefully cataloged. And one speculation that I'd like to throw out is that I wonder if a person like Daniel may have had something to do with that, because he would later have contact with various individuals, Cyrus himself. And is that part of the mechanism God used to be able to return these exact things and not have stuff mixed in from other gods and other temples, but simply the things that were in the temple here? It's interesting to think about. Nonetheless, 2 Kings chapter 24 and verse 10. At that time, the servants of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came up against Jerusalem. The city was besieged. Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came against the city, and his servants did besiege it. Verse 12, and Jehoiachin, the king of Judah, went out to the king of Babylon, he and his mother, his servants, his princes, his officers, and the king of Babylon took him the eighth year of his reign. And then in verse 13, and he carried out thence, or from there, all the treasures of the house of the Lord. All of the treasures. Remember, they had, well, we'll look at some of those things in a moment. And the treasures of the king's house. And it says, and cut in pieces all the vessels of gold which Solomon, king of Israel, had made in the temple of the Eternal, as the Eternal had said. Now, first of all, we ask, why would the Babylonians take all this stuff? Well, it was symbolic. You see, it was symbolic that their God was more powerful than any other God, because I could raid their temple with no consequences, take all the valuable things. It shows our God is most powerful. And secondarily, it was very demoralizing for the people. When a captive people had their God defeated and all the valuables taken away, it was very demoralizing. Not only was it demoralizing, it was financially debilitating. How do you raise another army with no king's treasure or tax money and no temple money? Well, you don't. So the Babylonians had a reasonable approach in that sense as far as carnal thinking. Now, in verse 13 it says, and cut in pieces all the vessels of gold. So the question is, what did they take and what did they cut up? The Hebrew word for cut in pieces is kotsats, and it means to cut off or to amputate. Interesting. Jacinius, in his Hebrew lexicon, says it means to cut away or cut loose. So, did the Babylonians simply take everything, cut it into pieces, the way the King James seems to indicate? Probably not. Why would you take beautifully crafted things and destroy them? Well, sometimes people do that. But on the whole, much of their value is lost if that's done. The craftsmanship is as valuable, if not more valuable, than the raw material itself. So, it's very likely when it says they cut away or amputated or cut loose, what it talked about was they cut away, they removed everything. They cut away, they amputated everything of value. Now, there are indications later on with not this temple, not the next temple, but the very next temple, Herod's temple, when that was finally destroyed, the Romans actually burned it. And they apparently, the story goes, the Roman soldiers actually pried the rocks apart after the fire to get out the gold that had melted. Babylonians didn't burn the place, most likely. They tore it apart. So that's what's being described here. The gold leafing that would have been decorations, or the curtains, the gold pieces that held curtains, things like that, all that would have been cut loose or taken away or removed along the way. So it's not necessarily that they chopped everything up. There's not necessarily any record of that. But that may be what happened to some of the things. Let's look at 1 Kings chapter 7. What were some of the implements that are being described here? 1 Kings chapter 7 and verse 48. 1 Kings 7 verse 48. Solomon's temple here is being described, and some of the things that are being used, the implements or the tools that are being described. We think of vessels, we think of cups. Well, how many cups do you need in the temple? Well, enough for people to drink out of, drink offerings maybe poured out. You need vases, you need bowls to gather blood or to various things, the various offerings. When you had a meal offering, you had something to carry the flour in that you poured out as a meal offering. So there are all kinds of different implements that would be used in the temple. 1 Kings chapter 7 in verse 48. We'll read a few of them here. Solomon made all the vessels, same word, that we see in Daniel, or I should say in Ezra. Solomon made all the vessels that pertained unto the house of the Eternal, the altar of gold, and the table of gold, whereupon the showbread was, and the candlesticks of pure gold, five on the right side, five on the left, the menorah, before the oracle, with the flowers, and the lamps, and the tongs of gold. So, you know, you pick up salad with tongs. Well, they picked up various things with tongs. They had meat hooks. They had all kinds of different knives and forks and spoons and candle putter-outers called snuffers, which is what you do to a candle. You snuff it out. All these things were made of gold. And so these were the things that the Babylonians took away and that were cataloged as being from the temple in Jerusalem, stored, and they knew exactly where they were. And then they were sent back with Ezra, or during the time of Ezra, first with Zerubbabel. Then in verse 50, and the bowls, and the snuffers, and the bessords, and the spoons, and the censers, pure gold, the hinges of gold, both for the doors of the inner house, the most holy place, and for the doors of the house, to wit of the temple. So when it talks about they cut asunder or they cut out, they cut in pieces, they probably would have taken the hinges that were made of gold. So they tore the place apart to get anything of value out of it. So it was, they ended all their work, etc. The rest of verse 51. King Solomon made for the house of the Lord. Solomon brought in the things which David his father had dedicated, even silver, gold, vessels, did he put among the treasures of the house of the Lord. As you know, David began building and organizing, or at least organizing and making things before Solomon ever began the project, storing those things in preparation for the temple. So those were the things that were stolen, that were taken out of the temple, and now they're going to be returned. So let's go back then to the book of Ezra. The question always comes up at this point where you talk about the Babylonians taking all the stuff of value. What about the Ark of the Covenant? Of course, the answer to that is, ask Indiana Jones. He apparently knows. What about the Ark of the Covenant? Some take this 1 Kings 7 issue, or I should say the 2 Kings 24 issue, that they cut in pieces, and say they just destroyed the Ark of the Covenant. They cut it in pieces, stole the gold off of it, burned it, melted it down, and it's gone. Well, that's possible. Although, being the most sacred object of all, probably being the one of the greatest value, it's unlikely that the Babylonians would have done that. Now, again, some reason that to show complete superiority over this god, they destroyed his chair, his throne, his seat, the Ark of the Covenant. Now, that's a possibility. And yet, there's no record of the Babylonians doing that. And you'd think of such an important step would have been recorded somewhere. So we really don't know what might have happened to the ark. And of course, this has been the source of a great deal of myth and lore over the past, about 2,000 years or more. It's not listed in the official list of things taken to Babylon. It's not listed here as coming back to Babylon or back to Jerusalem from Babylon. So there are a number of theories. And if you can't sleep at night, go onto the internet, type in Ark of the Covenant or Lost Ark of the Covenant, and you'll have reading for the next year at least. And trust me, it will put you to sleep pretty quickly after that. Although there's lots of interesting theories. One, of course, as we mentioned, was just simply cut up for gold and to show domination and superiority. Most seem to feel that it was scurried out of the temple before the Babylonians were able to steal it, and it was hidden. So there are Jewish groups, for example, the Temple Institute. They're dedicated to rebuilding the temple in Jerusalem. And they've worked very hard to try to scholarly analyze every bit of the Exodus account of where Moses was told what to make, how big to make it, what to make it of, what to cover it with, what clothing, etc., etc. And they're in the process of making all these things in preparation for the temple actually being built. Now, they they have a bit of a problem when you say the lost Ark of the Covenant, because they claim they know exactly where it is. They say it's hidden, it's not lost. Now, for some reason, they'll never reveal where it is. Now, maybe they do know, but there are several theories. Some say it's buried under the Temple Mount. I mean, literally buried in the dirt, because they didn't want the Babylonians to get it, so they buried it. Others say it's stored in a cave under the Temple Mount. There's a fellow from Britain, for example, who says that he's crawled through the caves underneath these honeycomb-like caves underneath the Temple Mount, and he's actually seen it with his own eyes, the Ark of the Covenant. It's under there, but he wasn't allowed to take any pictures. And he wasn't allowed to take anything out. And once the Jewish authorities found out about it, they sealed it again so no one else can ever see it. I would say he's smoking something? No, I don't know. Drinking something? I don't know. Because he also says that just before he found it, a person appeared to him who he claims apparently was an angel and told him exactly where to look to find this, and somehow it's been sealed up since that time. He's also the one who... Well, never mind. What else he claims? So, there are those who say when Solomon built the temple, he also... had an understanding that God would allow the temple to be destroyed someday. And so he built, in essence, an escape hatch and a place to store the Ark of the Covenant in the case that that would come up. There is quite a strong tradition that the Ark of the Covenant is in Ethiopia and has been there since the time of Solomon, frankly. And the theory goes, and it is apparently true, that there is quite a large Jewish contingency in Ethiopia, part of the diaspora, but not the diaspora from Babylon, but long before that. The Queen of Sheba, when she came to visit Solomon, tradition is very strong that she and Solomon got together, if we could use the colloquial, and on the way back to Ethiopia, she had a son that was Solomon's son. His name is Menelech, and he became the ruler of Ethiopia. And that line continued until 1974. Emperor Haile Selassie was the last of that line of individuals to rule Ethiopia. And they say Menelech, when he was 20 years old, went back to Jerusalem, and actually some of the people in his caravan stole the Ark of the Covenant, and on the way back, he discovered that they had taken it. And so he reasoned that since God hadn't killed him yet, he must approve of this transfer. So they say it's in a small church, a Christian church in Ethiopia, and only one person on earth is ever allowed to see it, and that is the keeper of the ark. And I'm sure it's stored right next to the Holy Grail. No, I don't know. I'm being a little facetious, but I mean, they're very serious about that. They honestly feel or say that that's the case. So whether it is or not, I guess someday we'll see. One of the wilder theories is that it's in a museum in Zimbabwe, that it was taken down the Nile River, then to the coast, and out around the Africa to Zimbabwe, and somehow ended up in a museum there, and somehow turned from a box to a cylinder. But there are burn marks on it, which indicate pre-gunpowder being used, and that's what killed people when they opened it. So anyway, there's lots of theories. None of them are particularly good. Probably the hidden or burial one is the most logical if the Babylonians didn't destroy it. If it still exists, I'm sure it will be made obvious at the appropriate time. And then, of course, you'll have to find out if it's a fraud, a remake, or if it's the real thing. So time will tell. But nonetheless, there's a very strong idea that it never was destroyed, that it was hidden somewhere. I guarantee it's probably not in a warehouse in Washington, D.C., which is what Indiana Jones, apparently it got left in a warehouse by the end of the movie. So we'll see. All right, let's go on from there. It mentions, again, Cyrus the king brought forth the vessels of the house of the Lord. So all these bowls, snuffers, candlesticks, lighting, all kinds of things were brought out, brought forth out of Jerusalem, and had them put in the house of his gods. Even though Cyrus, king of Persia, brought forth by the hand of Mithridath, the treasurer, and numbered them unto Sheshbazzar, the prince of Judah. So not only were they cataloged when they went in, they were also cataloged again when they came out. And so the lists were compared to make sure they matched. Now again, you have to wonder, how did they keep such accurate records, and why did they do so? Again, was Daniel involved with this somewhere along the way to make sure all these things were there and then taken and then put back? Because it's interesting that the night that Babylon fell, what did Daniel say to Belshazzar, the king of Babylon? That night, they specifically took vessels or cups that were in the temple in Jerusalem. They brought them to their banquet so that Belshazzar and his concubines and his wives and his partygoers could all drink wine out of the goblets that were used in the temple. Daniel said that. You have taken these vessels from the temple and used them in this party. And he said, your time is up. Your days are numbered. It's over. And that night is when Babylon fell to the Medes and the Persians. So Daniel seems to have understood where these things were, what they were, and he knew that that night that's what they were drinking out of at the party. Now my guess is, once the party was over, Daniel had people, you know, go collect those things, wash them up and put them back in storage. Now I don't know that, that's complete speculation, but Daniel must have had something to do with this, since he knew that these were the vessels from the temple from Jerusalem. Well, let's go on from there. Verse 8 again. Even those King Cyrus, or the Cyrus king of Persia, brought forth by the hand of Mithridath, the treasurer, numbered them unto Sheshbazzar, the prince of Judah. The question then in verse 8 is, who is Sheshbazzar? Who is this individual? It says, all of these things were given to this individual. Well, we ask the question, don't have an absolute answer, but it seems that if we turn over to chapter 5 in verse 14, we see Sheshbazzar mentioned again. Chapter 5 in verse 14. And the vessels also of gold and silver of the house of God, which Nebuchadnezzar took out of the temple that was in Jerusalem and brought them into the temple of Babylon, those did Cyrus, king of Persia, take out of the temple of Babylon, and they were delivered unto one whose name was Sheshbazzar. Well, we read that earlier, but notice the last phrase, whom he had made governor. So whoever Sheshbazzar is, he was the governor of Judah. Now notice in verse 16, then came the same Sheshbazzar, and laid the foundation of the house of God, which is in Jerusalem. Since that time, even till now, it has been building and yet is not finished. So in this official letter to a later Persian empire, Sheshbazzar is named as the governor of Judah and the one who lays the foundation of the temple. And yet, if you turn back a page, or maybe it's on the same page in your Bible, chapter 5 in verse 2, chapter 5 in verse 2 says, "Then rose up Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Jeshua, the son of Jozadak, and began to build the house of God, which is at Jerusalem." So in this case, it's Zerubbabel and the priest Joshua who begin the house of God. So is it Sheshbazzar? Is it Zerubbabel? Well, it seems that the majority opinion, or the most logical explanation, is that Sheshbazzar seems to be one and the same with Zerubbabel. One is his name, the other is his title, very likely, the governor or the deputy of the king of Persia. Because that word governor can also be translated deputy. So it is. There are other possibilities, of course, but I think the weight of evidence, at least in my opinion, seems that this makes the most sense, that Zerubbabel and Sheshbazzar are the same individual. And when it's referring in the Hebrew, in essence, to the leader, it says Zerubbabel. When it's writing to the Persians or discussing the Persian document, then it uses the term Sheshbazzar, which would be his title. So that would seem to make sense in that regard. Now, Zerubbabel was also the grandson of the former Jewish king, Jeconiah. So as a result, he could properly be referred to as the Prince of Judah. So if we go back to chapter 1, in verse 8, end of verse 8 says, "Number them unto Sheshbazzar, the prince of Judah." So he actually was of the royal line, so it makes sense for him to be labeled in that way as the prince of Judah. All right, verse 9. "This is the number of them, 30 chargers of gold." So apparently they had race cars back then. Chargers of gold. That's a pretty fancy car, I would say. Most of you don't know what a charger is. I'm sorry. That badly dates some of us. Do they make chargers anymore? Probably not. Oh, they still make them. All right. Very good. Okay, so still a funny joke. All right. Okay, still not funny anyway. 1,000 chargers of silver, 9 and 20 knives, 30 basins of gold, silver basins of a second sort, 410, and other vessels, 1,000. All the vessels of gold and silver were 5,400. And these did Sheshbazzar bring up with them of the captivity that were brought up from Babylon unto Jerusalem. These would have been stored for a long time in Judea before ever being used in the entirety of the temple service. So we're talking about a huge amount of items. First, it lists 2,499. Probably lists the entirety, the larger items, and then the 1,000 or more of other things. The total in verse 11 says, all the vessels of 5,400. So seemingly, if you total up the things in verses 9 and 10, you get 2,499, and yet verse 11 says the total was 5,400. So lots of things were brought back that weren't cataloged in this short two verses of the book of Ezra. Now again, if you hold your finger here, we're just about finished with chapter 1. Turn to Jeremiah chapter 21. Chapter 27 in verse 21. Jeremiah 27, verse 21. Jeremiah here, prior to the fall of Babylon, so this would have been 70 years earlier, or 75 years maybe earlier, Jeremiah was inspired to write this prophecy. And what we just read in Ezra fulfills this prophecy. One of the great proofs of the Bible, of course, is the fulfillment of prophecy. Jeremiah 27 and verse 21. "Yes, thus says the Eternal of Hosts, the God of Israel, concerning the vessels that remain in the house of the Lord and in the house of the king of Judah and of Jerusalem, they shall be carried to Babylon. And there they shall be until the day that I visit them, says the Eternal. Then will I bring them up and restore them to this place. So they will be restored. And this is the prophecy being fulfilled when we go back to Ezra chapter 1. Now again, the question is, today, will this happen again? Are all these vessels stored once again? And the answer is apparently not. The Romans were quite a different group than even the Assyrians, the Babylonians, or the Persians and the Medes. The Roman Empire is described as having those feet of iron that smash and destroy. And that's what the Romans did to the temple. They simply burned it to the ground, destroyed things. So anything that was left in the temple at that time would have been destroyed, melted down. The Romans didn't care. They had a completely different attitude in that regard. Their way of domination was completely destroy, and they did that. And so there's no indication that any of the things from the temple, which would have been that temple, Herod's temple, were saved at all. And so that's why the Temple Institute, for example, is trying to rebuild all these things in advance to the temple being built. All right, back to chapter 1. I was hoping we could maybe get through chapter 2 as well today. That may be a pipe dream, but we'll give it a shot. Chapter 2. Now these are the children of the province that went up out of the captivity of those which he had been carried away, whom Nebuchadnezzar the king of Babylon had carried away into Babylon, and came again to Jerusalem and Judah, every one unto his city. So verse 1 lets us know that almost the entire chapter is simply a list of families that migrated with Zerubbabel from Babylon to Jerusalem. So we're talking about 43,000 people in that environs, about that. This is a large migration of people, not nearly as large as, let's say, the migration from Egypt to the Promised Land over those 40 years. Many, many times more people there. But this is still no small thing. Imagine moving a city of 43,000 people. This is a major undertaking, no small effort whatsoever. So we see this listing of nearly 50,000 people. The journey probably would have taken them about 3.5 to 4 months, because that's what Ezra chronicles with his journey about 80 years later. So this is a long trip over some pretty difficult areas. So once they left Babylon, they would come basically through Haran, where Abram lived. From that point, they would follow the same route that he did down to the land of Canaan. So it would have been very symbolic for them to walk those same steps that Abraham did as he came out and God was calling him. I'm sure that meant a lot emotionally to the people. Now follows this listing of people. Very detailed list. Gives you a small sense of when God said he killed the firstborn in Egypt, how he could do that. I mean, if human beings can catalog things like this so accurately, certainly God can easily catalog with his mind so much more detail. But the interesting thing is that Nehemiah also presents a list of individuals that came back with Zerubbabel. And the lists are different. And of course, some people then say, see, these are unreliable lists. They're not useful because they differ. Well, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says this about these discrepancies. The discrepancy is sufficiently accounted for from the different circumstances in which the two registers were taken, that of Ezra having been made up at Babylon, while that of Nehemiah was drawn out in Judea after the walls of Jerusalem had been rebuilt. The lapse of so many years might well be expected to make a difference appear in the catalog through death or other causes. In other words, the theory is that Ezra's list are of those who were planning to go, those who'd volunteered to leave. Nehemiah's list are those who are actually there on site when the time arrives. So there's not huge differences between the list. One group, one family, had 125 less in Nehemiah's list than in Ezra's list. all the others had increases in theirs. So would you expect that? How about let's have a sign up for the night to be much observed? At what point is that list actually accurate? We have a list that we give to the caterer a month in advance, or let's say 2 weeks in advance, and it has a list of everybody who's going to be there. So we hand that list out. This is who's going to the night to be much observed. And then the night comes, and who's there? Well, somebody got sick, somebody couldn't come, somebody decided, well, I changed my mind, I need to go back to this or this person's house or whatever. So the list is going to vary. So you can imagine with a four-month trip that some people are going to maybe have a change of heart. Maybe they signed up originally and didn't go. So there's lots of reasons the list could be different. Gleason Archer in the New International Encyclopedia of Bible Difficulties says this: to be sure, regardless of the date when Nehemiah recorded this list, his express purpose was to give the exact number of those who had actually arrived at Jerusalem under the leadership of Zerubbabel and Jeshua back in 537 or 536. So in other words, is it possible some started out, got sick along the way, and turned back? Is it possible that some started out and said, this is crazy. This is crazy miserable, this marching stuff in the desert. I'm going back. Is that possible? Of course it is. John Mark was traveling with Paul, and all of a sudden he decided, I'm going back home. We're never told why he did, but he just did. So is it possible, 100 or 200? We could vary that? Well, of course it's possible. Very simple. So rather than approach the Bible with, you can't trust it, you approach it with, well, there's some explanation that we might not have been given that makes that clear. Archer continues, so also Ezra in the 450s apparently recorded their numbers, but it may well be that Ezra used the earlier list of those who originally announced their intention to join the caravan of returning colonists back in Babylonia, whereas Nehemiah's list reproduces the tally of those who actually arrived in Judea at the end of the long trek from Mesopotamia. Ever have people or ever study the issue of people leaving St. Louis for the California coast? How many left St. Louis and how many made it to California? A lot of people died on the way. So the lists from St. Louis and those in Oregon or in California would be very different as far as the total. So it's a simple explanation when you trust what the Bible says. If you distrust what the Bible says, you say, well, you see, in just a few pages, they get these lists mixed up and they can't agree. Well, again, you take that approach, you don't really have much faith, obviously, in what the Scriptures actually teach. In verse 2, it says, which came with Zerubbabel, Jeshua, Nehemiah. This is a different Nehemiah, by the way, than the one in the next book. And it goes through the lists of individuals. What we should mention about verse 2, it says, the number of the men at the very end of verse 2, the number of the men of the people of Israel. Because the phrase people of Israel is used, some would say all the Israelites came back to Jerusalem, to the area of Judea at this time. And simply that's not true. Back in chapter 1 in verse 5, we're told that it's only Judah, Benjamin, and Levi. They were all people of Israel, but they were not all the people of Israel. Let's drop down to verse 36. The priests of the children of Jedidiah, of the house of Jeshua, 973, children of Immer, 1,052, children of Pasher, 1,247, children of Harim, 1,017. So the priests and their families total 4,289, almost 10% of the total migration. That's a lot of priests. No doubt this would have been due to the prospect of rebuilding the temple, reinitiating the temple service. Now again, it would be quite a number of decades that would go by before that would actually happen. But that may be the reason for so many priests and their families coming back. As you go through the next few verses, you find out that there's just over 300 Levites that make the return. So the priests tend to have the glory job. The Levites tended to have all the work. So that may be why fewer Levites came along work here, work there, what does it really matter? Probably in Babylon, they had possessions, they had farms, they might have had shops. They go back to the Levitical system, and they're not landowners anymore. So maybe that had something to do with why Levites did not return in the same numbers. Verse 43 says, the Nethinims, the children of Zihon, and it goes on listing those individuals. The Nethinim, who were the Nethinim? The Nethinim, the word means the given ones or the dedicated ones. Apparently, these were individuals that were not Israelites, but they served the priests, they served the Levites, and Jewish tradition tends to identify the Nethinim with the Gibeonites, who had been assigned by Joshua to assist the Levites in the more menial tasks of the land. You might remember the story. Israelites come in, take over the land, and then a group of people comes to them. They're in rags. They're dusty. They got moldy bread in their packs. And they say, we've traveled from a long way to make peace with you because we realize your God is the real God and He's given you victory and we want to make peace. And Joshua consults with the other individuals in Israel and they decide, yes, let's make peace with these people. So they make this pact that we promise we won't kill you. We won't attack your stuff. Oh, by the way, where do you live? Oh, here. Here? They were Gibeonites. They lived right there. So Joshua had been deceived. And yet he had given his word that they wouldn't kill them. So they made them slaves, in essence. They made them water bearers. They made them wood choppers. And the Nethinim were probably those individuals descended from that group of people. At least that's probably the best theory in that regard. If you'd like to jot down a reference that way, you can jot down Joshua chapter 9 in verse 27. Let's go down to verse 62. Again, most of the chapter is a list of just individuals and the families that came to the area of Jerusalem. Verse 62. These, it talks about a number of individuals, these sought their register among those that were reckoned by genealogy, but they were not found. Therefore, they were as polluted, put from the priesthood. So in other words, there were groups of individual families who said, we're part of the priestly line. But they could not verify that by their genealogy. Now again, it gives you an idea that there was very careful record keeping amongst the Jews all during these years of captivity. They knew who they were. They knew who their families were. And they had record of these things. But there were a few families that could not produce records that showed they were actually from the priestly tribe, or descended from Aaron, in other words. Verse 63, and the Tirshatha said to them that they should not eat of the most holy things till there stood up a priest with Urim and Tumim at that time. So, in essence, what they were saying is that you can't prove you're in the priesthood, so you can't serve there. Now, he didn't call them liars. Interesting. Whoever this Tirshatha was, he didn't call them liars. Interesting point. What he told them is since you can't prove it, it wouldn't be right to eat from the priestly foodstuffs, from the offerings that were given, because you can't prove who you are. But maybe there'll come a time when a priest who has the Urim and Tumim, the fancy stones that could show God's will. We'll talk about that another time, possibly, until that's available. So he wasn't completely shutting the door on them, but since there's no one who could determine God's will in that way, they simply said, now's not the time. Now the word Tirshatha, in the King James, is translated governor if you have a New King James Bible or other translation. That was a Persian title. It was the one to be feared. The approximate translation today would be His Excellency. So again, that's probably the governor. That probably would have been Zerubbabel at the time. Making that decision finally because there was no genealogy. Verses 64 through 67 totals the whole assembly. Verse 64, the whole congregation together was 42,360. So over 42,000 individuals made the trek. Now, if you pause there, you go back to the beginning of chapter 2, you add up all the numbers of the people listed in chapter 2, and you only get 29,818. Now, I'm taking that for granted that I looked up that figure. I didn't count it myself. I'm not a math guy, but this is my kind of math. You add up 29,000, you come up with a total of 43,000. I would be good at that kind of math. Well, what's the point? 43,000 is the total. Who's not being counted in chapter 2? Well, it's very likely that the 43,000 includes all the women and all the children, whereas the list itself probably lists just the heads of the households. So 43,200 and whatever, 42,360 was the total number of everybody all together. Verse 65, besides their servants and their maids, of whom there were 7,337. So in addition to the 43,000, there were over 7,000 slaves as well. So the ratio of slaves to citizens, 1 to 6, was relatively high. Now, what would that indicate? It would indicate a couple things. It would indicate that the Jews in Babylon were pretty prosperous because many of them had slaves. It would also indicate that the treatment of the slaves probably was pretty good because they were willing to make that trip rather than die in Babylon. So that's a possibility as well. Goes on to mention something near and dear to my heart, the end of verse 65. It says there were 200 singing men and singing women. 200 professional musicians. These were not temple musicians listed earlier in the chapter. These were professional singers, probably employed for banquets and feasts and funerals. So there again, their presence would be an indication of luxury, of pretty good prosperity there. Reminds me of the story of the little boy who said to his mother, "Mom, when I grow up, I want to be a jazz musician." And she said, "Now, son, you know you can't do both of those." I've told that joke to my jazz musician family members, and they always laugh and agree. You're absolutely right. You can't grow up and be a musician. I mean, it's just not possible. Okay, I'm being facetious. I just offended all the musicians in the audience and on the internet. I'm sorry. It's a stereotype, I know, but probably true more often than not true. It also lists here in verse 66. Better change the topic pretty quickly. Verses 66 and 67, many of the Jewish people coming back had horses, a couple hundred horses listed here, 736, camels, animals of burden that would carry the various loads. Prior to this time, horses in Israel were only used for war. And so this would indicate that, again, there was a certain level of prosperity that had been attained in Babylon, and as a result, they had lots of animals to carry their burdens on the way. Verses 68 then through 70, on arriving back in Judah, it mentions some of the chief of the fathers, when they came to the house of the Lord, which is at Jerusalem, offered freely for the house of God to set it up in his place. In other words, there was an offering to build the beginnings of the temple. They gave after their ability unto the treasure of the work 61,000 drams of gold, 5,000 pounds of silver, 100 priests' garments. So again, these things were probably being made in advance and donated by individuals or families for the purpose of getting the temple things started. Now again, we'll simply say that the figures of Ezra and Nehemiah don't match. Ezra rounds off the figures, and Ezra apparently gives much more precise detail. So it could be two different collections. It could be, again, that rounding off issue. It could be that Ezra gives the total of both together of these offerings, that Nehemiah just counts one of them. Nonetheless, Ezra's numbers are larger than Nehemiah's. And again, if Ezra was going to forge a document, you would make sure that each of those numbers is exactly the same. So obviously forgery is not really a reasonable thing. As we close the chapter, drams of gold, 61,000 it says, drams of gold. There's a lot of controversy, frankly, on what this unit of measurement was as far as gold is concerned. But I think most would probably agree that we're talking about over 1,000 pounds of gold. Over 1,000 pounds. Now again, gold is very strictly regulated in our nation, so none of us have probably ever seen a pound of gold. This would have been an impressive amount. If it was 1,133 pounds of gold, or the equivalent of that, at this morning's price of $1,563.18 per ounce, that would be $28,337,327 and a little change that was donated. This is a lot of money that was donated for the temple. And that was very encouraging, I'm sure. Very exciting to see. Hard to say when that money would have been used, where it would have been stored in the meantime before the actual temple was built, and the foundation laid, etc. But that's about $670 per person that was donated for the starting of the temple, plus the garments that were involved. So what a great offering that was offered to help the fledgling community get started, get the temple off the ground. So it puts me in mind a little bit of the offering that you recently gave as well to get the preaching of the gospel off the ground. So with that, we'll close at the end of chapter 2 and pick up next time at the beginning of Ezra chapter 3.